Today at Reader's Corner, we welcome Kurt Anderson, author of Evil Geniuses, The Unmaking of America, A Recent History. I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to Reader's Corner. When did America give up on fairness? In the New York Times best-selling book, Evil Geniuses, The Unmaking of America, Kurt Anderson, author of Fantasyland, tells the epic story of how America decided that big business gets whatever it wants, only the rich get richer, and nothing could ever change. And he charts a way back to the future. Why and how did America take such a wrong turn? This deeply researched and brilliantly woven cultural, economic, and political chronicle offers a fresh, provocative, and eye-opening history of America's undoing, naming names, showing receipts, and unsparingly assigning blame to the radical right, a complacent and complicit establishment, and liberal, useful idiots, among whom he includes himself. Author Walter Isaacson called Evil Geniuses the one book everyone must read as we figure out how to rebuild our country. Kurt Anderson is author of Heyday and Turn of the Century, and he frequently writes for The New Yorker and Vanity Fair. He recently concluded 20 years as host of the Peabody Award-winning public radio program Studio 360, which he co-created. He was co-founder of Spy Magazine and has been a columnist and critic for The New Yorker and Time. Kurt Anderson, welcome back to Reader's Corner.
Just my pleasure to be back, Bob. Thank you.
So let's begin by having you kind of sum this book up for us, as you did in your first chapter when you distinguished between the New Deal and the Raw Deal. And you pointed out that your parents lived in a different economy than the one we're living in since the 1980s. What are some of the obvious differences between those two periods of time?
Well, my parents, in fact, were born, both of them in Nebraska in the 1920s, when it was more like in the 1920s it became in the 1980s. But they grew up into and were teenagers during the Great Depression and the New Deal and fought in the war and the rest. But what happened in the New Deal was, when the economy went kaplooey and collapsed in so many ways, more than it ever had, you know, in the Depression, we got together and, through the federal government, figured out how to both fix it in the short term by giving people jobs and relief and all that, but then also rejigger the economic system so that there was a floor for people, so that there was security, you know, so that it was fairer than it had been without all of the New Deal creations. And so there was Social Security, of course, so that being old didn't mean you were poor, as it did until 1940 and Social Security payments started, that people could organize unions, that really there was not an apparatus for that to be legal until the 1930s in the New Deal, you know, getting rid of child labor and establishing the first minimum wage and on and on and on, along with aggressive enforcement of antitrust laws, which had been around by that point for almost half a century. We decided, we together, America, that we should establish some ways in which the system, the economic system, would be fairer than it had been, and really built a structure for that to happen. And that worked pretty well for 40 years of our incredible prosperity from 1945 to about 1980. And incredible prosperity with most boats economically, leaving aside the problem, ongoing problems of racism and women not working or getting paid as much and all that. But the rich and the middle and the poor, as America became more prosperous and grew for 30 or 40 years, all grew at the same rate. And there was mobility. You could rise into different socioeconomic classes. You could go to college cheaply, and on and on and on. There was this sense. Of course, it wasn't a perfectly fair society, what society is, but America had gotten fairer, and it was working well with high tax rates on the rich and all the rest, but growth kept on going, businesses kept on growing. And then, as I talk about in Evil Geniuses, in starting in the 70s, through the 70s, and then in high gear in the 80s, there was a paradigm shift, and we went from the New Deal to the Raw Deal and decided, the New Deal, yeah, that was fine at the time, but we don't need that anymore. We can have a different way of thinking about what's fair. And instead of about what's fair, it's every man for himself and get as much as you can, and selfishness and greed are good. And that was really a turning point. And you know, I'd spent years thinking, oh, it's not that simple. And of course, it isn't that simple. And that's why I've written a complicated book about it. But it is simpler than I ever gave it credit for, what happened around 1980.
Well, in order for the 80s to produce this re-engineered economy, and most of that economy was produced, by the way, as you point out so obviously, in the United States Congress, for one, but there had to be a philosophical foundation for this. Mm-hmm. And you spend quite a bit of time talking about those few individuals who really did capture the interest of the more conservative folks, I suppose you could say, in the body politic, and convince them that that this was all a good idea to increase the values for the rich and leave the poor behind. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, and of course, it was seldom put that bluntly and starkly, like, yeah, let's make the rich do fine, maybe the most affluent 20%, and everybody else to hell with you. But that was the effect. But there was the very intelligent, brilliant economist, Milton Friedman, who, for instance, who was key to this whole process, who had been, although his intelligence and brilliance were recognized widely, and his ideas were kind of on the fringe during the 1940s and during the 1950s and during the 1960s, when he, from the get-go, simply didn't like the New Deal, didn't want that kind of government intervention in the economy, wanted everybody to sink or swim or win or not without government helping them, really, frankly. But starting in the 1960s, when all kinds of outrageous and fringy ideas, left, right, new age, nutty, whatever, suddenly became considered respectable possibilities, that kind of libertarianism, which was still a very fringe idea in America, and certainly in American economics, got more and more traction. And he became famous during the 1960s, Milton Friedman. And in 1970, just as on the one hand, people certainly in big business and on the right were afraid that America was about to have a left-wing revolution of some kind, that here comes Milton Friedman in, of all places, the New York Times Magazine, giving his Friedman Doctrine, which wasn't new in terms of what Friedman had been saying for years, but was new in terms of simplifying it down to a few thousand words in the New York Times for its millions of readers, saying, business people, all that matters are profits, period, end of story, full stop. You shouldn't try to make society more equitable. You don't have to worry about hiring fairly without racial discrimination. You don't have to worry about if you pollute the environment. All of that stuff is none of your business. Profits, profits, profits. And that was a kind of, the first big shot of what? Oh, my God, for people in big business, for the wealthy, for people on the economic right to say, this is our time. Let's use this moment of flux, this kind of late 60s, end of the late 60s moment of flux to push these radical ideas, which they knew were radical. And then they teamed up, got people like Charles Koch and David Koch, the Koch brothers, who starting in the early 70s, were pushing these ideas anywhere they could. And within in a fairly short period of time, this basic notion of economic fairness and justice is what we do here in America, and all boats rise together, to switch that to no, wealth and power can do whatever it needs to do to fortify and increase its wealth and power. And if rich people get richer and everybody else loses out, sorry, Charlie. And so in many ways, through creating think tanks and professorships and all, and this whole kind of counter-establishment, the basic norms and ideas about these things were changed in a very short matter of time. Certainly in a decade, enough to get Ronald Reagan elected, and then in a generation, enough to stick with it and restructure the economy for decades to come.
I'm Bob Custer. This is Reader's Corner. You're listening to Kurt Anderson talking about his book, Evil Geniuses, The Unmaking of America, A Recent History. One piece of your analysis that really reminded me of another time in my life was the growth of these think tanks, which you mentioned, but also these associations like ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council. I think you said it was funded by the Koch brothers. And at the time in the 1980s, I was in the Illinois legislature. And we began to notice that a number of our colleagues were leaving what was the kind of middle of the road, nonpartisan, bipartisan association called the National Conference of State Legislatures and going off for their own summer travel plans with ALEC, with the American Legislative Exchange Program.
Wow, you were there. You
ALEC
saw it.
Did. They developed these templates for the 50 states. And as a legislator, all you had to do is show up and they'd have you back in your home state introducing some of the stuff you're describing here in your book.
Well, I'm glad to hear that firsthand report of how that happened, because it was, and that was just, that was a hugely important part, but under the radar, state, as you probably know, state legislators, whatever, people, that wasn't at the, you know, on everybody's radar, but it was one of a dozen entities like that that were suddenly created starting in the 70s and through the 80s, think tanks and things like ALEC and things like the Federalist Society to really fight this long war. And it was so effective in all of these pieces. I mean, and you talk about ALEC, which was this very hard right entity that recruited all these Republican state legislators around the country and say, here's a bill you should introduce in the Illinois state legislature or the Nebraska unicameral or wherever. And it was like a franchise operation in a way, like here are the McDonald's burgers we want you to create everywhere. Go out and do it. And there was nothing in all these ways, nothing equivalent on the other side. So they you know, got away with murder.
And it wasn't just the Republicans, because as you point out in your book, Democrats played a role here. I think at one point you say the Democrats got played by the rich and by the people like the Koch brothers. But talk about the tax cut, deregulations, the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau, Schumer and representing New York, and what's that get you?
Yeah, I mean, and again, as I was getting out of college in the late 70s, and there was suddenly this new version of liberalism called neoliberalism. And of course, neoliberalism these days means a lot of different things, but there was this thing called the Washington Monthly, and there were all of the new Democrats like Gary Hart and Bill Bradley and so forth, who were not old-fashioned liberals, but were willing to look at everything freshly and compromise. And maybe there were things from the right that were useful and so forth. And that seemed, after 40 years of New Deal liberal kind of hegemony in America, that seemed like, well, we're still in charge, right? We liberals, let's go out and compromise and move to the center. And that seemed kind of exciting. And what happened is, it was like a bunch of essentially earnest young people going into war that they didn't realize was a war, that there was at the same time this incredibly single-minded, economically right-wing counter-establishment that was not there to compromise. They were there to achieve permanent ultimate victory and keep moving to the right as these young new liberals and new Democrats were moving to meet them. So, yeah, and that started. And then, of course, with Bill Clinton becoming president, who was a big player in that move of the Democratic Party to the center, which, again, was not all bad. And it, you know, he got elected president and thus validated the idea of moving to the center. But what happened, I think, in the story I tell, is that Democrats didn't parse what it was about quote unquote liberalism and the left that was politically palatable or politically toxic or not. And it was all like, oh yeah, we'll just move to the center in all these ways, including economics. And by doing so, they abandoned their roots as the party of the working class and the party of unions and all the rest. And so by the 90s, you have a situation where, you know, a working class person, a white working class person, would look at the two parties and say, well, neither of them cares about my economic interests, so that's gone. But one of them hates the same people I do and and seems to be resentful of the same things I'm resentful of. The other one, no, not. So I'll go Republican. And so it was a kind of callousness, among other things, and I think a not not seeing, sort of ceasing to be the alternative to the right. And so, again, by the 90s, certainly, there was no national economic left vision. I mean, there was somebody like Jesse Jackson running for president being that, but we all knew he couldn't be nominated or elected president. So it was sort of a nominal thing. And there was, you know, Democrats economically kind of reduced themselves to the position of what previously had been liberal Republicans. So there was no disagreement. There were disagreements on things like gay marriage and abortion and so on, of course, all the cultural issues in which there was ferocious disagreement, as there, of course, still is. But on economics, not so much. I mean, the Democrats came along and tried to soften the harshest measures of the right. And as the right had envisioned, cleaned up their deficits after the Reagan administration. Bill Clinton balances the budget after the terrible deficits of the early aughts. Barack Obama comes in and reduces the deficit and debt. And that's how they were played, by being the good boys and the good girls and the moderates and the restrained people when it came to economics. And really, you know, again, abandoning their union brothers as unions were really crushed starting in the 1980s and never, as I say, putting up a real alternative vision until maybe starting in the last decade or so.
Yeah, by the way, we're going to have Stephen Greenhouse on Reader's Corner in a couple of weeks. He wrote a book called Beaten Down, Worked Up, The Past, mm-hmm. Present, and Future of American Labor. And it really plays off of what you have to say about the way labor has declined over these last few years. And I just finished the first part of his book, and he points out so many things that labor unions did to improve the workplace and to make things safe for people, not just workers even, but just in general. In the meantime, you're listening to Kurt Anderson. He has written a book called Evil Geniuses, The Unmaking of America. Kurt, I'd like to take us to a chapter that you called yourself at the outset your longest, the chapter on how Wall Street ate America. Because there, I think you've done such a perfect job of showing that the devices and the techniques that were used to leave people behind while others gorged themselves. And I wonder, maybe you want to talk to us about LBOs and the job they played in wrecking chain stores like Toys R Us or The Limited or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, and that chapter, really, I had to read because I didn't really understand it. I mean, I've been a journalist. I've been an editor. I followed the news and I understood what became known as financialization, you know, enough to more or less understand. But I really had no idea how thoroughgoing and profound it was that you know, we talk about, and the corny cliche is, oh, it's all about Wall Street instead of Main Street. And I never really understood what that meant until I saw what happened so quickly around 1980. The before and after in terms of the size of the financial industry, its power over business and how CEOs conduct their businesses, was really, it became so extreme so quickly. It's really extraordinary, and also led to all kinds of things like the increase in CEO salaries by tenfold in really a decade or so around then. And then there was all this loose money and easy credit. You know, of course, that was not bad for lots of civilians who could then afford to live a little better or buy a house easier and all that, but it went crazy. And it also went crazy at the top. And what I really realized is that so much of the effect, and who knows the plan, who knows if the evil geniuses of finance got together in 1980 and like Mr. Burns on The Simpsons plotted their evil thing. I don't think so exactly, but there was more plotting and coordination again than I ever realized. And for instance, the loose money that was suddenly given to financiers to finance, as opposed to companies to build their companies, hire more workers, buy machinery, create exports, all the things that companies do, and that back when it was just this boring services industry that Wall Street would do is, oh, yeah, we'll raise some capital for you by selling some stocks, and there you go. So suddenly, junk bonds were invented. There had always been junk bonds. The phrase junk bonds meant when a company issued a bond to borrow money and it was doing so poorly and it became so risky that it fell into disrepute as a junk bond, for which they had to pay higher and higher interest rates in order to get anybody to lend them money. Well, what started around 1980 was the junk bond was created from scratch. This too risky, unreliable, high interest rate thing, for financiers to borrow money, was created from scratch, which allowed all kinds of people who weren't interested in buying and building a company for the long term in the Warren Buffett sense, but simply by putting astonishingly little money down, in some cases hundreds of thousands, to borrow hundreds of millions, take over a company, fire people, and make it and use all of its profits to pay themselves, to pay the interest on the huge debt they'd mounted up to take over the company, and then get out. And again, it not every instance of that was rapacious. Not every instance of that destroyed a perfectly good company, but so many did, and it became so much just the way business was conceived. So much of business was conceived of is as a where the companies, the actual businesses out in the world, became pretexts for financiers and sharpies to come in, make a killing, get out, move on. And of course, it goes on and on. As you know, as you say, it's a long chapter, and it's about how credit card debt mounted and how mortgages became too freely given to keep this kind of Ponzi scheme that our finance industry became going. And then even when it all came a cropper in 2008, there was some minor reform quickly, but it didn't stop going. It didn't lead to any kind of New Deal style change in how that operates. And again, if you look before and after, as I try to chart in the book, the degree to which stocks and bonds and finance are the business of America in a way they weren't until they were made that way, along with all these other radical changes that happened in the 1980s. It's really just astonishing. It is astonishing, and it's why somebody like Elizabeth Warren, who got into politics via trying to put some sensible controls and restraint and regulations back on Wall Street and finance to make this free market economy work better, right? As she says, I'm a capitalist to my bones. She's not a socialist. She wants this thing to work better, as did our rich president, Franklin Roosevelt, 70 years ago, 80 years ago, 90 years ago, practically.
Right. One of the metrics used to often help the layman understand the word inequality when it comes to income, especially, is to compare the distance between the CEO's salary and the workforce salary, say 1980s till the present time. I wonder if you could comment on that. I know you've addressed this in your book. There's billions and billions of CEO compensation now enjoyed by those folks that wasn't back in the day.
Well, and it's an extreme version of inequality, but it's a very illustrative one because it's just the most extreme version of the overall inequality that this country has increased amazingly in the last 40 years. So CEOs for decades, basically from before the World War II through 1980, the average CEO of a big American company earned about 50 or 60 times as much money as their average worker. So if their average worker, let's say, earned the equivalent of $40,000 a year, that CEO would make $2.5 million in today's dollars. Suddenly, during the 80s and 90s, they were making the average CEO was making 300, 400 times as much. So instead of the 40,000 of his average employee, he was suddenly making 10 million, 15 million. And then it got up to 1,000 in some cases. So this, and it happened so quickly. And I, in terms of my own journey to awareness, I was aware that this was happening vaguely, but until I did the research, I didn't realize how quickly it had happened, nor how without sense it was. It wasn't as though, there was sudden, why was there so much bidding up of CEOs' salaries so quickly? It wasn't like, you know, a new species of genius CEOs came along, and we had to pay them 100 times as much as we paid them a few years earlier. It was all part of this same transformation of norms about the rich getting richer and screw everyone else. So, but as I say, that's just an extreme version, the CEO versus average worker pay of the general inequality. I mean, the fact that, and it's not just, it is, of course, the 1% and the 0.1% and the 0.01%, the super rich who've gotten so much richer and take such a large percentage of America's wealth now. The fact is, it's not that the 1% did well and 99 and everyone else did it kind of okay. So the focus on the billionaires being so grotesquely wealthy, kind of, to me, hides disguises the really astonishing fact, which is that 80% of Americans have either treaded water economically or lost or sunk in the last 40 years. 80%. So, right. So yeah, 20%, the upper middle class and the rich and the super rich have done better, but that's only a fifth of us. And so that inequality, again, now we've reached levels that we had back, you know, in 1920 and have for a while, and have done so. And people have said to me, well, with technology and globalization, countries all over the world have become more unequal in Europe and Australia and Canada. And that's true, but only slightly, as opposed to this enormous inequality that has happened here. And why is that? That's because of this whole body of regulations and laws and norms that we changed, while the rest of this, what we used to call the civilized world and the rich world, kept building and using the safe social safety nets that they built to make sure that the way the economic pie was cut, remained basically fair, as it had been since World War II. We, the United States, went a different way.
Maybe a much less extreme example of this is something you call the big lie, and that is replacing the fixed pension system with the 401k.
Yeah.
I mean, that affects so many Americans.
Well, and again, that was not, I mean, the 401k was just this tiny little rule change in the early 80s that who knew it was going to suddenly create this or be a means for creating this entirely new way that people were able to retire or not, but it did. Yes, from World War II through the 70s, the new American norm in this great middle class moment, the golden moment of America, was that more and more private companies, and of course, public employers as well, were providing pensions that existed on top of Social Security, right? And sometimes you would contribute, but basically it was a fixed pension. You, if you work here 25 or 30 years or whatever it is, are going to receive this when you retire, Mr. or Mrs. U.S. steel worker, along with really cheap medical health care insurance for which there was minimal copays and all the rest. Those two things, pensions and affordable health care, around the same time, it was decided without any much social discussion, without being part of our politics, that nope, this is going to change. We're not going to do that anymore. And again, in a fairly rapid period time of the 80s and 90s, that conventional private fixed pension was phased out by more and more and more private companies as healthcare, employer provided healthcare became more and more expensive. And again, it's not as though Americans decided because Ronald Reagan said, yeah, let's get rid of pensions and affordable health care, okay, as part of the morning in America. That was never said. It was just this vaguer thing of, oh, it's individualism and it's business unleashed and all that immediately led to this unraveling, this tearing apart of this New Deal system that had worked pretty well for people for so many years. And when I tell my children, who are now grown and scrabbling like the rest of the millennials, that, you know, when I got out of college, fixed pensions were the thing. And you didn't even think about healthcare because it covered everything. You know, it worked so much better so relatively recently. Now I'm old, but we're only talking about 40 years ago, you know?
Well, you close your book with some thoughts and principles on how to get back on track. And for my last question, I'd like to ask you to comment on resetting the balance of power in favor of the majority versus the wealthy and big business and what have you. But even more specifically, I was absolutely fascinated by a Harvard Business School and Duke University survey that you include in the final pages of your book. I guess what you're trying to do is offer some hope that Americans really aren't as bought in to this system of the rich get everything and the rest of us get little, as you might think, because apparently this survey put forward some countries not named that had various features to them. And I'll let you explain the rest.
Yeah, it was a great experiment. And by the great psychologist, Dan Ariely, and his collaborator on the study, they asked a whole bunch of Americans. They had them say, what would be a fair division of income and a fair division of wealth in this country? You know, you draw the lines where it should be on a pie chart. And they did that. And Republicans and Democrats alike thought what would be fair is what, you know, plenty of Republicans today would call socialist. It was much more equal than what it was when the study was done, what it is now, when it's even more unequal. And then they said, okay, here are three options. This hypothetical country where everybody was absolutely equal, this hypothetical country, and this other third hypothetical country. Well, one of the hypothetical countries was the real income and wealth distribution in the United States. And one of them was the real wealth and income distribution in Sweden. And 92% of Americans of all parties and persuasions, of course, chose the Swedish version of economic equality as the preferable one over the real American one, taking away the Sweden versus the US. And so many, the thing is, so much survey research, when you can kind of take things out of the code words, oh, is this socialist or not? Or, oh, what? If you just say, what's fair? What is fair, people? Whatever it is about minimum wage or income equality, you don't find as much disagreement. And you find huge majorities of people say, yeah, that's fair. And which, of course, makes one see all the more the way in which the right and the Republican Party is just so devoted as its bottom line to not letting people see how unfair we've gotten and how what a crappy social safety net we have and all the rest compared to the rest of the rich world. And so we'll see. I mean, I am a natural optimist, not a ridiculous one, but I am a natural optimist. And I kind of in the last chapter of the book, I wrote in, you know, less than a year ago as the pandemic was just beginning and into the spring of last year. And I do think that this crisis, you know, not unlike perhaps the 1930s and the Great Depression and the New Deal, is creating enough of a sense of flux and enough of a sense of, wow, government can do things and is essential to do things like, say, distribute vaccines that it can do and sort of helping to maybe rock the world enough and the existing partisan talking points enough that people can begin thinking differently about the rules and regulations and norms that we use to establish what is or isn't fair. So I'm not without hope that out of this crisis, maybe things will get a little better and wake enough people up to say, yeah, this isn't working. And whatever I think about, you know, racial issues or abortion or cultural issues or how immigration should or shouldn't work, this idea that it really has become a rigged system, that, by the way, our last president, the one who we had until a couple of weeks ago, campaigned on, that this was a rigged economic system. He sounded, when he was talking about Wall Street and the economy, Donald Trump did, sounded like Bernie Sanders. Of course, he didn't govern that way. And he just did what the Republican, as I call them, evil geniuses wanted, which is on economics, which is gigantic tax cuts for the well-to-do and big business and rolling back regulation and all the rest. But he sensed that his base would respond to this idea of a rigged system if it came from somebody like him rather than somebody, say, like Elizabeth Warren. So I think, you know, I mean, day to day, we still have the parties we have and the cable news channels we have and all the rest. But I am not without hope beginning to see some breakup and some shifts in who thinks what about these issues that really are my subject in Evil Geniuses.
Well, all I can say is that our listeners should get out and get a copy of Evil Geniuses, The Unmaking of America, A Recent History by Kurt Anderson. Kurt, thanks so much for joining us today, and especially, as I said, for writing this book. And all I can say is thank you for joining us. And again, thanks for Evil Geniuses.
Thank you so much, Bob. It is always a pleasure to talk to you. And if I have another book in a few years, I hope I can come back.
Please, Will, we'd love it. Thanks so much. Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.